Good afternoon. Illinois Appellate Court, First District Court is now in session. The First Division, the Honorable Justice Michael B. Hyman presiding, case number 20-0919, People versus Robert Schultz.
Good afternoon. I'm Justice Michael Hyman. With me is Justice Aprilia Paczynski and Justice Mary Ellen Coghlan. We will conduct ourselves as if we were in the courtroom and that we probably may interrupt you. Please finish your statement, and then if you would go to our questions. The appellant has 20 minutes. You reserve some of that time for rebuttal. Let us know how much when you introduce yourself.
My apologies, Your Honors. Can you see? You can see and hear me now?
We can see and hear you.
Okay, great. I apologize.
No problem. No need to apologize. We're used to the technicalities. Okay, we've all had them. So Mr. Steinberg, will you please introduce yourself and how much time you want for rebuttal?
Mr. Steinberg, representing Robert Schultz. I'm of the Office of the Appellate Defender. I would like 3 minutes of rebuttal, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Good afternoon, Counsel. Assistant State's Attorney Julie Rixey on behalf of the people.
Thank you very much. Mr. Steinberg, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. This court should reverse and remand this case for second stage proceedings because at the first stage of proceedings, Robert Schultz provided an arguable basis that his 25-year sentence without the opportunity to earn good time credit or for parole violated Illinois's proportionate penalties clause. We recognize that that after the opening brief in this case, the decisions of Dorsey was issued as well as People v. Jones by the Illinois Supreme Court. However, those decisions do not foreclose relief here. Importantly, Schultz is making an as-applied challenge, Illinois constitutional challenge to the actually sentence imposed. Jones did not foreclose this type of challenge. In Jones, the Illinois Supreme Court only considered Jones's challenge on Eighth Amendment grounds, and they held that due to Mississippi v. Jones, that the discretionary 50-plus sentence in that case actually complied with the Eighth Amendment terms. Jones was actually challenging the threat of the life sentence. He did not challenge the part that was imposed. I'm going to direct your attention to paragraph 18 of the Jones opinion. And there, the Illinois Supreme Court said, if the statutory scheme had actually been applied in this case and set petitioner's life sentence, i.e. if a mandatory life sentence would have been imposed, petitioner's argument would have presented a claim and that we could have reviewed the merits. Here, unlike Jones, Schultz is actually challenging the sentence imposed by the court. He's not challenging a hypothetical sentence that he was facing. He's arguing that T.I. and under Jones, despite his plea, he's still able to argue this. A court would never allow a defendant to agree to an unconstitutional excessive sentence that could result in a host of results. Here, let's look at the facts. Jones, Mr. Schultz got a 25-year sentence for murder. While it is technically not a de facto life sentence under murder, he does have grounds for relief. Under Dorsey stressed the importance of good time credit.
Yeah, but the Dorsey was a case of 40 plus. We're not even close to 40. So how does that even have anything to do with this case? This case is 25 years, which is only five years over the minimum of 20.
When Mr. Schultz is challenging his plea, he wants the ability for rehabilitation. And also the state on page 24.
Right, he wants the ability for rehabilitation, right? Okay. And isn't it true that Mr. Schultz waived his pre-sentencing information, the report, investigation, pre-sentencing investigation?
When we review yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so he waived it. he waived that, and that would have had that information about rehabilitation. Now, so you're saying even though he waived it, we're supposed to, what are we supposed to do with that waiver?
That waiver only applies to the PSI.
But again, without the PSI, that's what would get into the background and so forth about rehabilitation. He waived it. He knew what he was, there was, this was a deal that was cut, right? And he knew what he was doing. You're not saying he didn't know about that was cut.
Justice Hyman, I am actually saying he did not know he was waiving a proportionate penalties clause. When you review the colloquy, they go over his right to a jury trial. They discuss the benefits of a jury trial. They discuss that he's waiving it. They also discuss his PSI. When I review the plea colloquy, when I review the sentencing order, when I review the jury waiver form, I do not see an express and no involuntary waiver of right to an unconstitutional sentence.
How is a sentence unconstitutional? I don't understand. When he's given up that right.
Wait, perhaps I can narrow this down a little bit, if you'll excuse me, Justice Hyman. When he waived the PSI, he was waiving everything that had happened in the past. And what I'm hearing Attorney Steinberg say is that he wants the opportunity now and from the time he started to serve a sentence and into the future to show that he has become rehabilitated. So it's a question of PSI past or rehabilitation future. Is that a correct summary, Mr. Steinberg?
Yes. And the PSI is a separate issue than whether he waived a constitutional right to a proportionate penalties clause argument.
Okay. And your argument is based in part on the Miller string of cases that base their argument on the fact that youth homicide defendants should have the opportunity to show that they have become rehabilitated. Not that they should get out of jail free. It's not a get out of jail free card. It's they should be allowed to go to the parole board. And in fact, the Illinois legislature recognized that when they passed that law in 2019, only they didn't pay attention to anybody like Mr. Schultz, who was sentenced before 2019.
Yeah, correct, Your Honor. They did not make it retroactive. Here, I mean, it's kind of an irony that someone who gets sentenced after Mr. Schultz could potentially get the benefit of good time credit or review of parole in 20 years, while Mr. Schultz cannot. And I want to go back to Dorsey. Dorsey stressed, and there the defendant argued that good time credit did not show an ability for rehabilitation. However, the Illinois Supreme Court actually expressly disagreed with that. They actually found that good time credit, which is currently denied to Mr. Schultz, could benefits not only safer prison populations, and it also shows that defendant has the ability to be rehabilitative, to be to comply with society's rules on the way out. By denying Mr. Schultz good time credit in this case, it doesn't serve the proportionate penalties clause, which is broader than the Eighth Amendment. And the fact that on page 24 of the state's brief, the state discusses the decision to remove the firearm enhancement in this case. And they said it was a goal to kind of, in light of his youth and potential rehabilitative potential. The best way to fulfill that rehabilitative potential is to create positive incentive for defendants like Mr. Schultz to show that he can get out, because we know the fact, yes, he's not serving a 40-year sentence of more than de facto life. We know he's gonna get out in 25 years when he's about 45, 46. As a society, and the Illinois Constitution provide an arguable basis for first aid that he should be allowed to demonstrate his rehabilitation.
But there's no case that Orthman won, which is that part that you rely on has been vacated. So it's as if it's no longer there.
Hyman? You know that you and I agree on a lot of things, but on Othman, what we don't agree on is that the court didn't like the argument about truth in sentencing. What we do agree on is that they said it was dicta and had to come out. So well, really,
it's vacated, but if it's out, you can't rely on
they va-
it.
But they vacated the dicta part. They didn't say it was wrong. They just vacated it because it was dicta.
Right. then you can't rely on it. But that, my point is, you can't rely on something that's not there.
You can't rely on it, but you can still rely on the reasoning. You can still say,
you can make your own reason. There's no case that says it. So, but my question is that every case that I'm aware of, including the two cases that the state recently cited as additional authority, is there any case that you can rely on that has allowed the as applied and under these circumstances in Illinois?
Daniels was a sentence of over 40 years, but it did allow a case to be
remanded. Well, that's kind of a big distinction, isn't it?
Well, that is a distinction, but the fact that
you can't rely on that. So
the intent.
I think that, and I'm interested in this too. What case are you relying on? What's your best case for your arguments?
Your Honor, it's honestly not only Daniels, but it's also the reasoning from Dorsey and the Miller line cases and Otham.
I mean, it kind of sounds like you're acknowledging that the current case law doesn't support any of your arguments, but you're hoping that we choose to ignore it, but we can't do that.
At the first stage of post-conviction proceedings, all the defendant has to show is an arguable basis in law and fact.
Daniels, is Daniels your best case that you're relying on, Mr. Steinberg?
Right now, Daniels and the reasoning from Dorsey regarding the benefits of a proportion of good time credit. This court should not ignore the benefits.
But you could also rely on the legislature's amendments in 2019 and the fact that for political reasons, the legislature decided not to make them retroactive, but that doesn't mean that they shouldn't have been retroactive. And it certainly shows that the legislature is aware of the fact that juvenile homicide defendants should have an opportunity to prove that they've been rehabilitated before the parole board.
Yes, that legislative change, as well as a proportionate penalties clause, shows Illinois's ever-evolving view on sentencing. Obviously, views of sentencing have changed since beginning of time. Illinois has chosen to focus on the balancing punishment with rehabilitative potential. And here we know Mr. Schultz has gotten out. Mr. Schultz has shown throughout his time in prison that he has ability to move on from those factors. Notably, if you look at the Miller factors and Harris factors, they apply in this case. He was 17 years old at the time of the offense. He was part of a gang. He did not have the power to extricate himself from.
He did not have a life sentence. All those cases that you're talking about, the whole line of cases, federal cases, all have to do with life sentences, right?
Yes.
Correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And so does and Dorsey, that's part of what Dorsey's all about too, is, you know, when is that 40 years? How do we determine? And this by far is not a life sentence. And it seems to me you've got a square peg you're trying to put in a round hole.
The fact that Mr. Schultz is not serving a life sentence, that he'll be released in 25 years, that he's not locked behind a key and will have to function in society, is all the more reason that a sentencing scheme and a punishment scheme needs to include good time credit or an opportunity for.
But we don't, how can we, well, so you're saying, I mean, he has to serve 20 years. You would agree to that?
Currently, right now, under truth and sentencing, he has to serve all 25.
But you're saying the minimum would be 20 years. Is that what you're saying?
Under Illinois, if he was sentenced.
Yeah, if you win this case, if we ruled in your favor, are you saying he can get under 20 years?
Possibly, but all I'm asking, my client is asking for remand for second stage proceedings for Mr. Schultz to put together an evidentiary rule on that.
And what would that show us, show the court?
It would conduct probably a full PSI. It might conduct a full PSI. It might conduct psychological examinations.
But the PSI and all of that was waived. So it seems like you want to have your cake. I mean, if he didn't waive it, then maybe your argument would have been a lot different here. But can he waive it and then take advantage of that waiver? Isn't that what he's doing?
Mr. Schultz is looking at ever-evolving Illinois case law, whether...
Well, it hasn't evolved that much. I mean, from what you're saying, Daniels being their best case, what has evolved is that the statute has evolved, but people, you know, we don't go back. We got to follow the law, okay? How do we get to where you want to go? How do we get to that second stage? And what is the key fact or case that gets us to be able to rule in your favor?
It's the fact under reason from Otham and in other cases. This case has reversed proceedings proportionate penalties clause in Akins or Barnes and a couple of cases not cited in the brief involving the mandatory firearm enhancement application of that to juveniles. That's currently debate. There's cases such as Hiller that disagree with those under the proportionate penalties clause. Akins and Barnes were actually less than de facto life sentence. I apologize, those cases were not cited in the briefs. But reasoning from those cases about the proportionate penalties being more expansive and being and focusing on rehabilitative potential. Importantly, cases such as Dorsey is an Eighth Amendment challenge. They never actually reached the proportionate penalties clause argument. And at no point during this plea agreement, was there an express waiver by Mr. Schultz that he said, I waive any double jeopardy constitutional violations. I waive a proportionate penalties clause investigation. I'm looking at the jury waiver now. I'm looking at the plea colloquy. At no point does he agree to serve an unconstitutional sentence or be imposed as a slave or any other thing that would be an illegal. If you take contract principles to their fullest extent, you can't agree to an illegal term of years. Here, Mr. Schultz is challenging the sentence imposed and the opportunity that Truth in Sentencing denies him to earn good time credit and show his rehabilitative potential. This court should reverse and remand and allow him the opportunity for him to show how that TIS is unconstitutional as applied to the facts of his case.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. You may proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Your Honors, the Circuit Court's summary dismissal of the petition at the first stage was proper. The petitioner did not present the gist of a constitutional claim because his petition lacked an arguable basis in fact or law. Therefore, we're asking the court to affirm the summary dismissal for three reasons. First of all, pursuant to our Supreme Court's decision in People versus Jones, the petitioner's constitutional claims, which were premised on the line of Miller cases, were waived by his knowing and voluntary plea. Jones is dispositive in this matter, Your Honors, because the petitioner knowingly and voluntarily entered into a negotiated plea, and he does not now, nor has he ever alleged any jurisdictional issues or malfeasance on the part of the state. Under our Supreme Court's reasoning in Jones, the petitioner here gained the present benefit of his plea agreement, including the dismissal of the 25-year firearm enhancement. And also the trial court exercised its discretion by accepting that plea. Therefore, he is now foreclosed from raising a constitutional claim to his sentence. At the time that people filed their brief, Your Honors, it was shortly after the Jones decision. So several of those cases were Rule 23 cases, which is why I filed a motion to cite additional authorities, which Your Honors granted last week, giving me permission to cite to the First District published case of People v. Watson. Watson is factually similar to this matter. In Watson, the petitioner was 17. He pled guilty to first-degree murder. He received a 32-year sentence. He also, as the petitioner here does, relies on Othman, the vacated portion of Othman, claiming that Truth in Sentencing, as it applies to him, violated the Eighth and the Proportionate Penalties Clause. His petition also was summarily dismissed and the petitioner appealed. Now, this court held, citing to Jones, that by accepting a plea agreement and pleading guilty, the petitioner waived the post-conviction claims he raised in his petition. Therefore, here, pursuant to Jones and Watson, the petitioner has also waived his constitutional challenges to his 25-year sentence. The second reason, Your Honors, we're asking that you affirm the summary dismissal is that the petitioner waived his proportionate penalties challenge for failure to raise it in his petition. As the court is obviously well aware, any claim of a denial of a constitutional right that's not raised in the original petition is waived, and an issue may not be raised for the first time on appeal. A review of the petition shows that the petitioner here made an Eighth Amendment violation claim, particularly pursuant to Section 8.
Let's assume that we're going to get to the heart of the issue. Sure. What is your third argument?
Sure. So, Your Honors, even if you did not find that he waived his proportionate penalties charge under either the Eighth Amendment or the proportionate penalty claim, petitioner's claim fails because petitioner's as-applied challenge is premised on Miller. Therefore, he must show that his sentence is a life sentence, whether that be natural, de facto, mandatory, discretionary. He cannot do that. And since he cannot show that he had a de facto life, he cannot make an arguable Miller claim because Miller does not extend relief to a juvenile who is not subject to a life sentence. This has been clearly laid out in the Illinois Supreme Court cases and United States Supreme Court cases of Miller, Dorsey, and Buffer. The truth in sentencing does not violate the eighth or the proportionate penalties when a juvenile receives a non-life sentence. And this is because, this was laid out in Dorsey, because a sentence of less than 40 years still affords a meaningful opportunity to obtain release based on demonstrated maturity and rehabilitation. And it also satisfies the restorative objective of the proportionate penalties clause.
Excuse me, Ms. Breisky, how is that possible if he's required to serve 100% of his 25-year sentence? How does he get the opportunity to demonstrate rehabilitation if no matter what he does, if he walks on water, he still has to serve 100% of 25 years? I don't understand the statement.
Sure, Your Honor. The Supreme Court has drawn that bright line at 40 years as being the amount of years that still allows a person coming out of jail to have the opportunity to gain the release demonstrated on the maturity and rehabilitation. So that was a line set by the court. And in this matter, because the defendant is relying on the protections of Miller, he states in his brief and in oral argument that sort of the issue for him is that the court didn't consider his age and maturity, his circumstances of his childhood, his rehabilitation potential when they issued their 25-year sentence. So he's claiming that
Actually the court said, oh, and you'll be able to get good time, which was not correct. The judge was wrong. The judge thought that he did not have to serve 100%, but he does have to serve 100%. So getting back to my walking on water, what does he have to do to get out before 25 years? Anything? Nothing?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I just want to make sure I'm following your question. When you say the court said that he did not have to serve 100%, could you clarify what you're
saying? The court said, you'd be able to appeal for parole. I think those were the words of the court. I've written down some of those. I can't find them right now. But the court made a mistake on that. The court was thinking he could apply for parole, but he cannot. He has to serve 100% of 25 years, no matter what he does.
The petitioner was informed during the plea that this was subject to truth in sentencing. So I believe, Your Honor, the section that you're referring to is in when the post-conviction court made its oral ruling on the pro se post-conviction petition. He was laying out that this was not a de facto life sentence. And I'll get to the page, exact page that you're talking about, because I do know what you're referring to, Your Honor. And
the judge said he is eligible for parole. It is that
the dismissal.
Per se life sentence.
But that is not a correct statement. He's not eligible for parole. It's record 239.
Yes, Your Honor. We argued in that part that reading in the context of that of the court's entire statement, he was merely indicating that the sentence was not a buffer per se life sentence rather than a term of years.
Sir, but the Illinois legislature did not limit its new law to people who were serving life sentences. It said anybody who's been sentenced for murder has the opportunity for parole after 20 years.
Yes, you're referring to the new sentence.
Except for Robert Schultz and anybody who was sentenced before 2019.
That's correct. That new sentencing law does say that it's only effective after 2019.
And it also does not say anybody who's sentenced to life or 40 years, any juvenile homicide defendant.
No, but in this particular matter, Your Honor, because the petitioner premised his argument on Miller, we're then looking at the Miller line of cases and the Dorsey line of
cases. I appreciate your position and I understand it, but Miller was a two-part decision. Everybody wants to focus on the life part, and we keep forgetting that the whole reason for the life part was the rehabilitation part, that youth offenders must be given an opportunity to demonstrate rehabilitation. And that has been part of Illinois law since, 1869 or something. So I'm constantly amazed that people will focus so much on what is a life sentence. A life sentence, 75 years, 45 years, 55 years, 40 years. The Illinois Supreme Court says 40 years. Right. Right. Miller didn't say that. Miller said you have to have the possibility of parole if you get a life sentence because rehabilitation is important. And then in every case after that, they have made the importance of rehabilitation a cornerstone of their decision. So when we're talking about rehabilitation here, and the Illinois legislature's efforts to encourage good behavior in prison, to encourage rehabilitation and recognition and rewards for that, there's no term of life involved. There's no term of years involved. It could be for any term of years.
Yes, Your Honor. Could you repeat your specific question?
Well, you're saying that because he based his argument on Miller, it can only be used if he was sentenced to life or in Illinois 40 years or more. And I'm saying because he based his argument on Miller and truth in sentencing, he can use it for any term of years because the whole basis of Miller and everything that followed it was that they have to be given an opportunity. They get these juveniles and emerging adults are clueless. We all know that. Anybody here have a teenage boy for a son? We know they're clueless. They do dopey things. And so the Supreme Court recognized that. The legislature recognized that. Emerging scientific research recognizes it and says, we have to give these young men a chance to demonstrate that they have been rehabilitated, not to get out of jail free card. They have to prove it. They have to work hard to prove it. They have to behave themselves. But if they do that, there's a reward for doing that. And why do we want to do that? Because we don't want to lock up people for 80 years who are no longer going to be committing crimes.
So if I follow Your Honor, what you're asking me is whether or not under their truth in sentencing, we are sort of foregoing the rehabilitative aspect by saying your sentence is 100%?
What I'm saying is, the Truth in Sentencing Act, which everybody, including President Clinton, who signed it, says now was a big mistake, says you have to serve 100% if you're guilty of murder. And that was applied to juveniles tried as adults in Illinois under a very bogus system that allowed state's attorneys without any oversight to transfer cases to adult court. Okay, fine. We're past that. Now we've got Schultz in front of us. He was 17 at the time of this horrible crime. He admits it was a horrible crime. I admit it was a horrible crime. Everybody admits it was a horrible crime. But we also have the chance to look at whether or not he has demonstrated some rehabilitative potential. And that can't be before 20 years. The legislature said you've got to stay in for 20 years. But after 20 years, you should get an opportunity to go to the parole board and say, look at all these things I've done. I've been good. I haven't got any marks against me. I've behaved myself. I'm rehabilitated. Let me out. And the parole board would make an informed decision. I think that applies whether you get a sentence of 25 years, 30 years, 40 years, 39 years, 37 years. I think it applies to any sentence of a juvenile homicide defendant. My colleagues don't agree with me, but that's what I think, because I think that rehabilitation is such an important part of how we're dealing with these emerging adults. And you're saying it only counts it can't count because Miller was only about life sentences. And I'm saying that I don't agree with you.
But let me follow up on Justice Puchinsky's question. If, for purposes of answering my question, agree that Justice Puchinsky's take on Miller, that it applies to every juvenile sentence, not just over in Illinois 40 years. Would our ruling change?
If Miller applied, are you saying in conjunction with the latest sentencing law?
Not the latest sentencing. Well, we can't apply the latest sentencing
law. Right.
So we're talking about this case, okay? Assuming that Miller applies to every juvenile conviction, does that mean that Schultz gets this second stage hearing?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because in this case, he under Dorsey, he did not receive a de facto life sentence.
No, but if we take away that, what I'm trying to say is, if is that the fulcrum of this whole case? Because if you're saying the reason, what distinguishes this case from what Justice Puchinsky is arguing is life sentence. And what I'm trying to take away is that issue. If I take away that issue, then Justice Puchinsky's correct?
That you're entitled to have an opportunity for parole. Is that, that's what you're asking? If we take away the de facto life.
Then this sentence would be, would have to go to second stage.
I suppose hypothetically, if you're saying that
it's a hypothetical, but yeah. I mean, because I know you're not going to recognize that as the law, and I'm not saying it is. I'm just saying if we assume Justice Puchinsky's argument, then that, let's say that it, that's the way the law looks like. Okay. I mean, that to me seemed to be the fulcrum between the differences between the two arguments here. That's what I'm trying to get down to. Or is there something else there with regard to Illinois law or federal law that still would prohibit this case going to second stage?
Well, I think one of the cases that we cited in our motion to cite additional authority, Richmond, I do realize is a Rule 23, so it's just persuasive authority at this point, Your Honor. But I do think that they discussed the idea in Richmond that even though the proportionate penalties provides greater protection, which if I'm following you, which is where I believe you're going with this, that with rehabilitation, proportionate penalties provides greater protection. The cases are still, in a way, they're still crossing paths with the Dorsey and Miller lines when these claims are made. So if you take away Dorsey and say there's no longer de facto life sentences, then you're basically just looking at proportionate penalty clause on its own is the way I would look at it. And then you're looking to see, does this shock the moral sense of the community? This was briefly touched on in our brief as well, that the court here did have some discretion. They didn't have to sentence Mr. Schultz to 25 years. They could have gone below that. They could have disagreed with the firearm enhancement dismissal. So there was some discretion there for the court, and the court still chose to accept the 25-year plea. So I hope I'm following your question, Your Honor, but the way I believe you're asking is if we take away de facto life, we're left with just, is this a violation of the proportionate penalties? And in this particular matter, for the senseless shooting, and you're right, Mr. Schultz in his petition does acknowledge his actions, and he does acknowledge it was senseless, but it's still an innocent victim's life and 5 years above the minimum. It doesn't shock the moral sense of the community.
Okay, thank you very much. You have the sense of my question, thank you.
Okay. Your Honor, if there's no more questions, I believe we covered our three reasons that we're asking Your Honors to affirm the summary dismissal under Jones, under waiver, and then of course under the petitioner's lack of a de facto life sentence. So with that, Your Honors, we would rest on our brief and the arguments set forth today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Steinberg.
Justice Hartman, may it please the court. This is not an easy case, despite the fact that Schultz did not receive a life sentence, and despite the fact that he did not receive a life sentence. The plain language of the proportionate penalties clause does not limit challenges to it based on how long their sentences are, the type of sentences, the age of the offender. There's no express discrimination against a de facto life sentence or a non-de facto life sentence in the proportionate penalties clause. Importantly, it stresses the ability of rehabilitation. And Dorsey, and for the state to say that time just provides an opportunity for rehabilitation, is expressly ignoring the fact that the Illinois Supreme Court in Dorsey, paragraph 63, said, we reject the claim that earning good time credit does not demonstrate rehabilitation or show readiness to re-enter society. And the inmate's behavior in prison tends to be indicative of his readiness and harbinger for future recidivism. They even quote the US Supreme Court by saying that these good time credit are designed to help prison. And they play a major role, good time credit, in furthering the institutional goal of modifying behavior and value systems to permit that defendants, when they're released, that they can live in society's rules. The state's asking this court to say, yeah, and the state argued about the importance of good time credit in Dorsey and how it shows rehabilitative potential. And now it's asking this court to completely ignore that. There are decisions where defendants have received less than 40 years, including one, I think earlier this week released by this court. But in those cases, the defendants have an opportunity to show the rehabilitative potential. Here, Mr. Schultz does not have the benefit of, cannot show his rehabilitative potential. He does not receive any benefit. The state talks about the benefit of the bargain. And they said, it provides ample rehabilitation for this plea provides ample rehabilitation, ample opportunity for rehabilitation. It does not without good time credit. It deprives the state and deprives Mr. Schultz of this valuable tool. And regarding waiver, he never waived his right to contest the constitutionality of the sentence. On page 193, the PSI waiver is just a PSI waiver. Also, when I look through the plea colloquy on pages 206 or 216, where you discuss the sentence, I don't see a waiver of the right of the plea. If you go back to Brady, which is cited in Jones, it talks about how a waiver of a constitutional right must be known, voluntary, intelligent. That's why during plea colloquies, judges discuss, they go over the right to jury trial. You're waiving other claims. Here, there are no such waiver on the record of a proportionate penalties clause. His background, again, he's earned his GED, become a certified tutor, and for these reasons, is there a question, Justice Coghlan?
No.
And for these reasons, he has stated an arguable basis that the deprivation of good time credit does not serve the sentencing goals of the proportionate penalties clause.
Thank you very much. Thank both of you for your briefs and for your arguments. We'll take the case under advisement and it will then be forthcoming. Thank you very much. Have a good afternoon to both.